And welcome to another one-off episode of House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell. I'm a political journalist, amongst other things. And I'm really delighted today to be joined by Jo Zammit Lucia. Have I said that right, Jo?
Yes, that's right.
And he's the author of a book called The New Political Capitalism, How Businesses and Societies Can Thrive in a Deeply Politicised World. Jo was previously had an executive career in multinational business and founded his own management advisory firm with offices in Cambridge, New York and Tokyo. I've only been to two out of three of those, but I'm sure we can get me to Tokyo eventually. And he also founded the Radix Network of Public Policy Think Tanks. So welcome to House of Comments, Jo.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, new political capitalism, boil it down for me in a nice, simple idea that even a numpty like me can understand.
So we've been through a phase, I think, in business, and we can come to why we've been through this phase. But we've been through a phase in business where the narrative that business people told themselves is that business is apolitical. That it's kind of almost above politics. There are many strands to that. And that worked during the kind of 80s, 90s, early part of this century. But now the world has changed. And although that statement of business is apolitical, and the best thing that politics can do is keep out of our way so that we can do business, although that statement was always false, the enormity of its falsity is becoming much more obvious now in many, many different ways. So we are realizing, and this is something that many people have realized for a long time, that business is part of our panoply of political institutions, and they cannot be apolitical. Business cannot be apolitical. And the politics that we're seeing at the moment, the political environment we're seeing in the moment, embroils business more and more in political issues by political being interpreted in the widest sense. We have an increasingly politicized environment, and business is just not used to dealing with that. So this is another change in the evolution of capitalism, where business people are going to have to learn to deal much more with political issues as a core part of doing business.
When you say political issues, I'd be really interested. Obviously, this is a book largely aimed at the business community, but as you make clear, it's there shouldn't be that mental separation of the business community and the political community, and the polity. They are actually all interactive. But when you say political issues, I'd be very interested to unpack a little bit what you mean by that, because I think people have very different conceptions of what politics is and is all about. And I think that too has changed in those years that you were talking about.
Absolutely. So whenever you say politics to non-political people, they tend to sort of squirm because they associate politics, the word politics, with electoral politics, which is the only time they think about it. And, you know, the dirty, and when you say politics and business, they associate it only with the dirty business of lobbying for narrow self-interest. Mm. But that's not politics is, at least that's not what politics is in the context that I'm trying to address it. So for me, politics is the mechanism by which we decide what kind of society we want to live in. We can only decide and implement that through the political system. In a democracy, it's done through elections, a battle of political ideas that is conducted more or less peacefully, if not always openly or honestly, but it's done peacefully, and there's a transfer of power. In other circumstances, the kind of society people live in is determined through revolution or you know, or through other means. But all these things are political. So by politics, I mean the process by which we determine what kind of society we live in. And we all have a role to play in that. And business has a big role to play because, you know, it employs people, it fires people. It puts services on the market that affect the kind of society we live in. I mean, look at AI and things like that. They're changing the kind of social media. They're changing the kind of society we live in. There are, you know, geopolitical issues that have always affected business, but increasingly so now that we have geopolitical polarization. We're living through the sadness of the Ukraine at the moment. But, you know, who would have thought, you know, in the heydays of the 80s and 90s, when we all thought that Western liberal democracy had won the battle of political ideas and it was the end of history, who would have imagined that the world's second largest economy was going to be an authoritarian regime, and the consequences of that. So all these issues both affect business and are affected by how business behaves. So that's what I mean by business being a highly political set of institutions.
And how would you see, so it's largely about business being reactive to the polity, but also influencing the polity, but not in the kind of traditional dark money lobbying.
Yes. And that is there, and that will continue. And some of it is dark, but not all of it is dark. You know, it's much of it is out in the open. You know, companies spend money on public affairs, which, you know, to try and fight for their self-interest, and that's fine as long as it's out in the open. But reactive is an interesting term because at the moment it is reactive, but business operates and has always operated within the socio-political cultural environment in which we live, and has to adapt to that. So that environment is changing, and political issues, which range, as I said, from do we invest in China to day-to-day operational issues like do we have single gender bathrooms in our offices, these are all political questions, are now affect the environment in which business operates and therefore affects business top to bottom. Mm. So the question is, how does business adapt to this emerging political environment? And for business, it's not helped by the fact that one of the characteristics of the current political environment is polarization. Because business has always lived in a world where they don't want to upset anybody because anybody might be their customer. Well, that's okay if you don't have a battle, a serious battle of political ideas across a broad spectrum out there. But when you do, like we have now, again, then whatever you do is going to please some and upset others. And although business has been touchy about that, there's no reason why they should. Because if you look at products that business sells, products or services, no business ever believes that they're going to appeal to every single human being. They know that they will appeal to some and not appeal to others. So the political positions that businesses and brands take will likewise appeal to some and not to others. But that doesn't mean that you don't take a position, and it's becoming increasingly impossible not to take a position.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I'm struck by the direction of travel from, I think it was in the 90s, where Michael Jordan sort of famously said, yeah, Republicans buy sneakers too.
Right.
To now, when there's, you know, you've got Colin Kaepernick not getting a contract because he took a knee, and then Nike putting him at the front of their advertising campaign.
Yes.
There's a very interesting essay, I don't know if you've read, by Helen Lewis called Woke Capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
I found very interesting, which is kind of, I think, makes quite an interesting companion to your book, because again, it's sort of about corporations doing exactly what you were just talking about, which is understanding where their market might be and appealing to them in an external fashion. So, as I say, Nike putting Colin Kaepernick on the front and foot of their advertising and making a business decision that that's where their customer base is more likely to be. But they're not maybe living those values so much internally. And this is not, I don't know enough about Nike as a company, but you mentioned sort of gender bathrooms, a decision about who can go in and out of a room that you already hold is probably financially easier than, say, making something that would make gender parity in the workplace much easier, like setting up funding and properly running a creche.
Yes.
And so that's that kind of where Helen's coming from, is this sort of patina of woke, which is not actually that political. It doesn't change things on a deeper level. So I'd be really interested in your thoughts on how this new approach to capitalism would change corporations as much as it would change their relationship with external parties.
Yes. So let's kind of dissect all that for a minute.
I do ask very long questions.
So let's start with the phrase woke capitalism. It's not a phrase I like, because it seems to me that the word woke has become a way of putting down those opinions with which we happen to disagree. You know, whatever we call woke are political opinions that some people hold, and they have every right to hold them, whether we agree with them or we disagree with them.
And I think what's interesting is that those political opinions would be held by Helen Lewis. So I think that's
right. Yes. So I think the point that obviously she's making is that these political issues that she chose to call woke cannot be ignored, and they have to be handled. But let's pull back a little bit, because you raised the issue of, you know, is the Nike jumping on the Black Lives Matter bandwagon an opportunistic thing, or is it who they are? I don't know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Nike haven't had a history of being advocates against racial discrimination. So, you know, the suspicion that this may be opportunistic and not embedded in terms of who they are is bound to be there, whether it's true or false. But let's pull back a little bit and think about what is business and what is business for. And, you know, throughout the kind of laissez-faire Washington consensus neoliberal era, which went from kind of the late 70s to, say, the early 2000s, there was this kind of perverse view of business that emerged that said business is there to make money. The purpose of business is to make money. Actually, Tony Blair came out and said that very explicitly, which for a Labour politician is kind of a bit unusual. But business is not there to make money. Business is there to provide value to its customers. And as a consequence of that, if they can do it well, they can make money. So I remember many years ago being in a meeting in a pharmaceutical company with commercial and R&D people, where the R&D people were presenting their ideas. And one of the commercial people got bored after a while and said, you know, well, this is all fine and dandy and all very scientifically interesting, but you guys seem to forget that we're here to make money. And the president of R&D said, was a wise Scotsman, said, laddie, we're not here to make money. We're here to make medicines that make people better. And if we do that well, we will make money. And that is common sense. And that has always been the purpose and the reason for existence of business. To provide a service and to provide a product or brand or whatever it is that adds value to customers. And as a consequence of that, they can make money. Now, what is happening is that how customers judge value or the value they expect from corporations is changing and broadening. So when before people used to buy something either because it just worked or because they loved the brand because it was chic or whatever it is, now they think, well, I expect more value to be delivered. I expect social value to be delivered. I expect this company to take a position on this and that. And I'm looking for that value before I buy that product. So if you like, the political has become part of the value proposition that business has to present to its audiences. Its audiences who are no longer just acting as consumers, you know, a term I hate, because it implies that the only value of a human being is how much he or she can consume. But they're thinking, feeling, and acting in their purchasing decisions more like citizens. So the citizen customer is a very different beast from the consumer customer. Added to that, there are all the pressures from NGOs, activists, investors wanting to tick their ESG boxes, politicians and the political system, wanting to resolve some of the issues and needing businesses to come along with that. So part of the value proposition that businesses now have to offer the world includes these political, defined in the broad sense, includes these political elements. And unless they provide these political elements, which is what the market wants, then they won't make money. Or at least not sustainably.
No, that's really... just coming back to that, absolutely. And I agree that that's definitely where we're landing. But again, I come back to my question about... the difference between putting Colin Kaepernick on an advert and closing your cheap labor factories in countries with less regulation.
Yes.
And how do we move business to this place in your book where they choose not to have or choose to have a factory in that country, but pay those workers properly?
Right. Well, let's again, first of all, let's be clear. Business is not monolithic.
Mm.
Okay. There are many businesses, yeah. All of which will do different things and explore different things. So what the way I would look at it is that there are some things that are starting to be considered business hygiene. In other words, they are there are things that you have to do now to be as a condition of being in business. We're not there yet, but cleaning up your supply chain is becoming one of those things. You know, it gives you competitive disadvantage if you don't do it. It doesn't give you much competitive advantage if you do it, because it's becoming a requirement for being in business. You know, just like we used to put children down the mines in this country, but we don't anymore. Okay, so it's one of those things where social expectations have evolved, and you know, you need to do certain things simply to be in business. Then there's the next element, which is that some companies will say, seeing as there are these political issues out there, and some people care about them, I can take those political issues and use them as a way of creating competitive advantage against other businesses. And that is tricky and difficult. So a company like Patagonia, for instance, if you go to the website of the company like Patagonia, the first words you will see is not buy my clothes, or we're a clothing company. The first words you'll see is we are in business to save the planet. So they've made it their mission and they've made it their purpose, and their business is structured around that. And there are two elements that make that authentic. One is that it was the basis on which Patagonia was founded by Yves Chouinard, who was an environmentalist and a lover of the outdoors. So it is part of Patagonia's DNA. It's very authentic. The second is, if you dig into their website further, what you find is a lot of explanation of the areas where they're still failing to achieve their purpose, where they, you know, we still have more to do. And this contrasts with some other companies who make some little program here and there, layered on to their business as usual, and then trumpet it as we're saving the planet.
Yeah.
And you know, people are not fools. You can't take people for fools. So you know, people see through all this. If you take another example, Benetton for many years made social justice its primary campaign. All their adverts were very, very powerful. Some found them very offensive, defending social justice. They never advertised their products even. Their brand was associated with something different. So I think there's a difference between the hygiene elements, things that you're going to have to do because the world no longer accepts them, but that everybody's going to be doing to a lesser or greater extent. So they're not going to give you much competitive advantage. And then there are the other elements that say, okay, in a highly politicized world, I can use these political issues. I can embed these political issues because it will attract a certain customer base and create competitive advantage.
That's brilliant. From my audiences and my perspective, this is a more political podcast than a business-facing podcast. I am a small business person, so I kind of have that hat on. I wouldn't say I'm terribly good at it, but I still got a roof over my head. That's about as much as we can ask at the moment.
That's exactly.
Where is the role of government in this? How does this informal partnership work, ideally?
So, you know, as always, it takes two to tango. And, you know, the reality of life is that the business way of thinking and the political way of thinking are very different. They're different worlds, different tribes. They speak a different language. They have a different culture. And that needs to come together, and it needs both sides to work together. So from the political perspective, I think, there also needs to be an effort that how do we partner with business? How do we leverage the power of private enterprise to achieve our political objectives in a way that benefits everybody? So how do we change this relationship from, and this is being a little bit crass about it, okay? So it's not as black and white as I'm just going to describe it, okay? But just to make it, how do we change the relationship from, you know, I want to do certain things and business won't like it and they'll lobby against it, and I'll have CEOs traipsing into my office every day telling me I shouldn't do this, but I want to do it. How do we get past the idea that some political parties are pro-business and others are anti-business? You know, how do we get past that the role of regulation is to hold business in check? You know, it's a policing role. How do we get to a mindset that says, to repeat a hackneyed phrase, we're all in this together? And, you know, we need to find a way whereby the political environment and what businesses can and want to do are traveling in the same direction as opposed to in opposite directions. So let's take the leveling up agenda that has just come out, okay? It is obvious to anybody that none of that, well, maybe not none of it, but very little of it can be delivered by government alone. It has to be delivered by private enterprise working to the same objectives. So if you're in government, you need to think, well, how do I do that? You know, what I would have liked to have seen is Michael Gove, when he was launching this white paper, being flanked by the president of the CBI, by the president of the Small Business Federation, by somebody in the city, and saying, you know, this is what, as a government, we're trying to achieve. And I have these people here who are here to tell you how they are going to contribute to us achieving this objective. So we need to move away from government setting policy and then trying to shoehorn business into it. And on the other side, some businesses trying to defend the status quo because that's what suited them, or trying to lobby for their own, you know, narrow self-interest, and somehow create an environment where this is seen as a productive partnership, not as a corrupting one, but as a productive one. And as to the role of regulation, you know, which is something I cover in the book, you know, there are two elements of regulation and both are necessary. One is a policing role. Okay, you have to, you know, because the world out there contains bad people and always will. So you have to have regulation to stop bad things happening. So that is necessary. But regulation is not really that. Regulation is the process by which we shape the nature of markets, by which we create the rules of the game within which markets operate. And that is a much broader conception of regulation. What sort of society do we want to live in? Therefore, how do we want markets to operate to deliver such a society? And therefore, what is the broad regulatory framework we have to put in place so that markets help create the sort of society we live in? Now, the trouble is that because of, you know, a significant number of rogue behaviors, the amount of time consumed by policing type regulations is too large and crowds out the more important element of regulation as shaping markets. And in shaping markets, there has to be a dialogue. There has to be a dialogue between business and government and civil society and others. But that dialogue has to be done in good faith. So what will happen, of course, is that once that dialogue is put in place, people will insert themselves into that dialogue simply to lobby for their own self-interest. Well, politicians need to ignore that and say, thank you very much, and move on. But there are plenty of business people out there, business associations, individual businesses, small and large, who do have this desire to shape markets in a way that benefits more people, benefits our society, gives us a society that we all want to live in, and that they can actually deliver a very nice, profitable, high return business within that shape market. So that's, I think, where politics and regulation needs to put its mind to.
It's really interesting. On a previous podcast, I interviewed Angela Regal about her book, which was sort of a similar conversation from the political angle in many ways. And we were trying to break down the difference between communism, socialism, market capitalism. And where I think we landed was the phrase socialism done well is a system that imposes moral rules on an amoral system to avoid immoral outcomes.
Okay.
But your conception of socialist capitalism in here is different from your conception of political capitalism. And I would maybe argue that there's actually just a difference of degree between how you impose those rules. Would that be fair?
Well, I think it is a question of degree. So I don't call it socialism. I sort of call it socialist capitalism. Because it is still a capitalist system. People can own property, and etc. It's simply a question of the nature and the degree of government intervention. And it seems to me that it all stems from your fundamental belief system. So I consider myself a classic English liberal. We don't have a classic English liberal party anymore in our politics, but that's where my philosophy comes from. And my starting point as a classic English liberal is a belief in people, that people are actually fundamentally good. They're not fundamentally amoral. They are actually fundamentally very moral creatures. And that, they all have a different definition of what sort of life they want to live in, what sort of life they want to live, and what works for them. And we should allow them to do that. But if you start from the belief that a belief in people, that people are fundamentally good, then you land in a very different place from if you start from the belief system that the system is fundamentally amoral.
So I do differentiate between amoral and immoral.
Okay, fine. Well, I believe in neither. that neither of those describes the vast majority of the population anywhere. Sure. There are criminals, there are immoral people, there are bad people around, but they are not the majority. They are a minority, and we cannot let our system be defined by the minority. Okay? So once you start to believe that the system needs huge government intervention because the world is full of bad people, then you're letting the bad people define your politics. And that, I think, is fundamentally mistaken, because then you decide that government has to put its fingers into everything, because otherwise it will be bad. And that, you know, in order to deliver a public service, everything has to be nationalized. In order to deliver this and that, you know, the government has to, you know, be sitting in on everybody's lap. That's where you get to if you stop believing that most people are good people. If you start from that belief system, then you don't get rid of the policing function, that's fine, but you see it for what it is, which is a minority of people that need to be dealt with. But you don't use it to define your system.
Right, so it's a difference. So the police, I mean, I think policing is interesting. I was thinking about your hygiene, your business hygiene example. Obviously, over the last 2 years, we've had quite a lot of government intervention into our personal hygiene.
Yes.
And that's not because we're all likely to go and cough on a stranger, but because those people who might cough near a stranger and not think about it need to have that raised in their brain, as it were.
Yes. And, you know, it's been a difficult period and there was no right way to address it. You know, it was fiendishly difficult. You know, we all can comfortably sit in our armchair and criticize the government for what it's done. But I, for one, am thankful I didn't have to make those difficult decisions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's give credit where credit is due, that these were fiendishly difficult decisions on which every single person in the country had their own opinion.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's so, you know, I think that, again, it's where you're starting from. We need to have rules of the game. You know, you can't play a game if it doesn't have rules.
Yeah.
A game doesn't exist unless it's a set of rules. So all these people who talk about the free market and talk about, you know, let's get rid of all the rules, you know, this is just abject nonsense. There is no such thing as the free market. Markets are always constructed because you need rules of the game if markets are to operate properly. Otherwise it's just worse than the Wild West, even the Wild West. And, you know, markets don't operate unless there are rules of the game, unless they're shaped by the political system. But we've got into this mindset of it's all about deregulation and getting rid of. Sure, there are lots of regulations that we can probably get rid of because they're petty. But fundamentally, business and markets can only operate within a set of rules. And those rules have to be politically determined.
Yeah.
So that's fine. But when you go further and start to say, well, actually, it's not just set of rules. Government has to do everything because people out there are amoral. And we're the only ones who are moral in this world, and we know what morality is, and it's our definition that is the only one that matters. Then you're starting to move towards authoritarianism, where, you know, I'm sure President Xi believes that he's the only one who knows how every Chinese citizen should behave. So, you know, at one end of the spectrum, we have this libertarian mentality, which is nonsensical. At the other end of the spectrum, we have this kind of push for increased government involvement in everybody's life and in business and delivering everything because nobody else can be trusted. And then you're veering towards an authoritarian mindset.
Absolutely. Where I think the debate is to be had is how we run that middle ground.
Absolutely. But I think the debate...
That's where politics and business and civil society need to have equal weight in the discussion in order to come to a sensible place that we can all live with.
Yes, and you know, we'll never come to a sensible place that we can all live with, because this is constantly dynamic.
Yeah.
The world changes, opinions change, technology changes the world, you know, geopolitical tensions change the world. So there is no such thing as a stable equilibrium. This is ever, ever changing. So we will keep evolving, we'll keep learning, we'll keep making mistakes, we'll keep tacking this way and that, depending on the prevailing political wind, but we'll keep doing our best and we'll keep working at it. It's a work, it's a work in progress that never ends. It's like the three-bodied problem in physics. There is no equilibrium. There is no answer. It's a process, and it's a process that never ends.
So I'm going to draw this to a close now, because that feels like a very natural, even though it's a process that never ends, it feels like a natural ending. If there were one lesson from the book, one or thought even from the book that you would like a political audience to take away, what do you think that would be?
I think the one thought that I would give a political audience is that they should see their primary role as shaping the nature of markets, shaping the rules of the game within which markets operate. That should be their role, and they should see their role as that, and how they decide which way to shape that is of course dependent on one's political philosophy and dependent on the socio-cultural mores of the time. And politicians have two roles. One is they have to respond to the socio-cultural mores of the time, but secondly, they also shape those, because they have power to do that. They have, you know, if they're good leaders, they can actually shape and direct those socio-cultural mores. So their role is both a responsive and a leadership one. And unfortunately, in my view, this politics by focus group has increased the responsive role that politicians are playing and somewhat undermined the leadership role. You know, if a focus group doesn't believe in something, then you should not just think, well, I need therefore to do it. You should also think, well, can I provide the leadership so that they do believe it in 6 months' time? And that, I fear, has been eroded by this kind of, you know, governing by focus group.
Great, thank you ever so much. And thank you so much for coming to talk to me today. It's been really interesting. Maybe I'll be a better business person and less political from now.
No, be political. We're all political.
Well, I should hope so, because my business is called Political Human. So
absolutely. Very good. Thank Fantastic. You so much. It's been a delight
Thank
to speak
you to you. So much, Joe. It's been great talking to you. And The New Political Capitalism is available from Bloomsbury, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, and Amazon.
And all other businesses.
And you can make your political choice
as to where you buy it.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me today. Just to say thank you to Robert McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production.